This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Kate.
Tell me.
Well, sounds very civilized.
We are civilized women. What have you been consuming in your eyes and ears?
Not mouth. Not mouth. Is that the other where you were leading us? I have been dying to tell you about this because I think I kept saying it in the evening at the writer's retreat that we went on. I kept saying, I've got something to tell you that's really interesting.
Yes, you did.
But I'm not telling you now.
Yeah, as is our way that sometimes we hold things back, you know, keep the dust dry. Go, exactly. Tell me.
I'm going to tell you. So there's a podcast called the Publishing Rodeo Podcast. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of it?
I have not.
Well, you are in for a treat. So the premise of the podcast is there are two best-selling authors. It's obviously a non-fiction podcast. Their names are Sunyi Dean and Scott Drakeford. They were both debut authors in 2022. They both wrote fantasy novels, so published in the same year. They were published by the same big publisher. Both best-sellers. And the whole podcast, which is in its early days, I think there's only about 5 episodes that's been released, but the whole podcast is about how their experiences differed and is basically just a behind the scenes on how publishing works.
Oh my God. I want this in my head immediately.
It is absolutely fascinating. So the episode that I want to tell you about is called Anatomy of a Bestseller Part 2. And coming off the back of a discussion about money that we had really recently, it is an episode that really talks to that in a very fascinating way. So both these authors are from the UK.
Yep.
And the bestseller list they made is the UK Sunday Times list.
Where are they on the bestseller list? Sorry.
I think they both topped it, right?
Oh my God.
Their respective months, which is a point in itself. It's an extremely English case study in that some things will translate, but other things won't.
Okay.
A key thing they both start by saying is they each made the bestseller list for a week in the week of release.
Yeah.
And that's the most common experience for a bestseller is to make the list in the week of release. Okay. So the Sunyi Dean's experience, her book came out in August, which is a peak period for book sales. She knew 6 months before that her book was a bestseller.
What?
Weird, right? So the thing that they talk about, which is this bit that's really particular to the UK, not that it does not exist elsewhere, but they talk about crates. So what you want is a crate book, and crates are basically subscription services in the UK, and they're a major way that books get sold. So a reader will buy a crate and they'll get a book a month. And maybe it's a themed crate around fantasy. Maybe it's a mainstream, appeal to anyone. But publishers talk about you want to be a crate book.
So
and it's
hold
book.
Up just for a second. Who is running these subscriptions? Because I know people like Amy and Laura, the Secret Book Club ones. Like there's subscriptions like that, but we're talking like big, big subscriptions.
Big, big subscriptions. There's one in particular that applies more to Scott Drakeford's experience, which was a bookseller that I don't know the name of that specializes in special copies of books.
Uh-huh.
So they'll create a special looking version of your book that at its like most special end would be a book that has like when you turn the book side on so you can see the pages and it might have a picture or something, or like a gold
fancy
cover. So there's a
expensive
particular
to make.
expensive to make, and there's a crate service attached to that particular bookstore. Anyway, so Sun Yi had sold so many crates that, and the crates range from sort of 1,500, 2,000 copies to 20,000 copies that you can sell if you get one of these subscriptions. Mm-hmm. And the type of book obviously has to appeal to a broad audience, but it can't be Richard Osman or someone who is going to be a bestseller on the back of previous sales or who they are. They also make this interesting point. Sunya makes this point that they also, a lot of the crates will try and get a more obscure book or two from a smaller publisher. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Sunya's experience, book comes out in August. She's sold so many of these subscriptions that in that first week is an immediate bestseller. The next week, she can't count all those sales. Stephen King's book comes out. You know, you're off the bestseller list. That's her experience. Scott's experience quite different. I should say Sun Yi's book is called The Book Eaters. Scott's book is called The Rise of the Mags, I think. It came out in February, which if it is not the slowest month in sales in the UK, it's up there as a very slow month. So he got his book got picked up by one of these special edition companies. So they made a fancy version. There were 2,000 copies that were going to be sold through that crate. Then basically, because it's a slower month, they just needed to hit this figure of around 5,000. So the publisher, the agent, you know, everybody did all they could to generate more interest on the back of the crate, but also just attempted to do small things like have a complete sales embargo until the first day. Sometimes booksellers might sell a book 3 days before, you know, it officially comes out. So working really hard to get this spike that then allowed him to get onto the bestseller list. And so he sold in the 5,000s. I was trying to see what that looked like. So the 5,000 was for the whole of the UK, which is 65 million people, which I think is an interesting, like, statistical comparison.
It is indeed. Wow.
Anyway, he too, if he had sold, well, maybe this is different from Sun Yi's experience, but if he had sold 5,000 the next week, would not have even made the top 10. So super fascinating. Aside from all this discussion on sales, though, one of the things they talk about is so their experience for both of them is as what they called tier one authors. Mm-hmm. So both were authors that the publisher is essentially putting everything that they can. They really see this as a book that's going to fly.
So our comparison might be when people are called lead titles. That's lead title similar. Yeah.
Comparison. Yep. But Sun Yi raises this point that I keep thinking about and think is really interesting, that you'll know if you're a tier one author, but nobody tells you if you're a tier two or a tier three or a however many tiers there are. And the benefit that would exist if, when you signed your contract, you signed for your enormous advance. And at the same time, they said, hey, listen, you know, you're a tier three author. We love the book. We're really excited to get it into the world, but you're not going to have a tier one experience, or we're going to give it a lot of love and care. We don't expect it to have the same readership.
Can I ask? I have so many questions.
Fascinating.
My first is that I just want to go and listen to this immediately. And I can see why you didn't tell me, because I would have listened to it, all of it, like, before we did this. Have you got any sense, like, have they recorded and got feedback, or can you see them on, God forbid, Twitter or anywhere else where they're getting responses from other authors about what they're saying, and whether or not other people in the industry know this information, or whether their brains are breaking at the thought of finding out?
That's actually a really interesting question, because when they were talking, part of me was like, are you allowed to say, like, oh my God, like, it feels like a layer of transparency that is startlingly, I kind of had the same questions. I didn't look into Twitter and those sorts of things. It's a new-ish podcast and one that I haven't really heard anyone talk about it. Someone
How
had commented
it?
Something on, it was something on Twitter. I went down just a random sort of rabbit hole and discovered it there. It's a funny little podcast in the sense that, what would I say? It's absolutely fascinating discussion, but it just feels like two people that came along with a tape deck and pressed play and record some ways. Like it feels really intimate in how they talk to each other. It feels very honest and candid, I suppose. But I really just this idea of transparency around your level of tier, I think is oddly appealing. And it might not seem, it's a sort of thing that might not seem like it would be. I think it's appealing because it's around that expectation and things to expect. Mm. My daughter is doing swimming with school at the moment, and she's on a relay team. And they've gotten through the school competition and district and division, and now they're at the next one. And they've scrimped into this, it's regional, and the next on is state. And I keep saying to her, oh, you know, it's going to be a lot of really, like, there's probably kids at this level that do squad lots of times a week, and you know, trying to sort of say, you're never going to make state. Like, you've got to be really happy to be where you are because you're just never going to make state. And she sort of nods and says, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But imagine if we do. And I feel like this is the author thing. You know, you sort of seeing some of these backdoor things that happen, like knowing in February that your book that does not come out for 6 months is already a bestseller, is the equivalent of having a parent say to you, you're probably not going to make state.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Okay, there's so many things that I want to say. First point is yes, about the transparency. I mean, this is like kind of what we're trying to do. And some of the complications when we were talking about money last week, because of that idea of, okay, well, what is commercial in confidence? What is actually a business thing? What is industry-wide? You know, like, so those things exist. But yes, absolutely, about expectation setting. It makes me think of, and we'll talk about Bridget's book, Reasons Not to Worry, on Stoicism, at a different time, because I don't have all of my notes clear in my head. But one of the really key things in that is that this idea of the Stoics was that your sphere of control is very small, right? So you can only control kind of your own character, your own behavior, and your own reactions. Everything else is absolutely outside of your control. And I met up with one of my gorgeous writers groups this week, with Penny Harrison and Penny Russin and Zana Freilon. And it was the first time in ages, possibly the first time this year, that we'd all four of us been in the same room. And what we do is generally at the end of the year, we make these kinds of bold statements about the kinds of things that we want to happen in our writing or creative life for the next year. And because we're obviously witches, we write them down in the back of my to-do list book. And then we keep them for the next year. And hilariously, we have a good track record, right? So we hadn't done this for a while.
Right. So how specific are you?
Like, pretty specific.
Will you say specific things?
Very specific. But one of the really interesting things when we did it this week, and that linked into this control stuff and expectation, is that I went to start writing down stuff about how I want The Hummingbird Effect, my new novel, to go. And then I couldn't kind of work out what I wanted to say about it, like what would be the measure of success. And then my other very wise, very clever friend said, it's not on the list. You can't control that. That's done. That was last year's thing. All you had to do was finish it, right? Everything from here, aside from you just doing the work that you already know you're going to do, that your publisher asked you to do, of promoting and the rest of it, everything else with the book, outside of your control. You can't control who reviews it. You can't control how many sales there are. You can't control any of that now, Kate. So it's off the list. Move on. That is
but
not
it's your funny business. That though, because so much of like a mood board or manifestation feels like the what you're told to do is to say, I want it to sell a million copies.
Yeah.
Like, that's the visual. So it, the two things are in tension, this Stoic idea of letting go and having a sphere of influence versus
it was very powerful. I felt like it was a very powerful thing of going, okay, yeah, you know, I know that the work ahead and what's to do, I'm like wise to all of that stuff. But yes, there is a certain amount of this that I just can't do. I am so going back. Obviously, this podcast, the Publishing Rodeo, is one that we listen to from the start and go through.
I reckon, well, this was episode 5, and I just like the sound of, like, when I read the blurb of that episode. I've since started going back. It's the view from the top.
Yeah.
So it, I mean, some of the things you like that they will make comments about or say is anchored in their own experience, and it's the sort of thing that, say, if you were a tier 10 author, it's like, I have no control over that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is very much that experience, but it is absolutely fascinating to see how things work behind the scenes and the inevitability of, you know, the types of work that go into making something a bestseller for this sort of case study. Yeah.
We will continue.
I also just like the idea of if you all know you're a tier two, if you know you're a tier two author, there's some sort of camaraderie in knowing there that other tier two authors exist. Like, I think there's something about that, that the relativity of experience is out of your hands, or that it's better acknowledged, something around that.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. Okay. Adding to list.
Fascinating. Tell me, what have you been reading, listening, consuming?
I might go with what I've been listening to, because this sounds like it's all industry stuff this week. So I listened back to an episode of Secrets from the Green Room, which is with Irma Gold and now also Karen Biggers. I've mentioned episodes from here before, but this episode, episode 26, is with booksellers. I highly recommend it. If you are a writer or a want-to-be writer, to listen to this episode. The three booksellers that Irma chats to are all Canberra booksellers. So Katarina Pearson from Harry Hartog, Alison Page, who's from Dimmicks but has just recently retired, and Peter Anado, who's from The Book Cow. And they all speak in this kind of panel situation about what they about things like sales and returns, about how far in advance they get books. Irma asks fabulous questions about exactly the questions that writers want to ask about, if I want to come in and sign books, when should I get in touch with you? You know, how far in advance? What is the best behavior that I could do? What is the worst behavior I could do? How do events work?
Is the worst behavior? Did any of them have any good, like?
Oh my gosh, the funniest
badly
one.
Badly behaved.
The funniest one, and I can't remember which of the booksellers this is. You got to go and listen to the whole episode because it's so funny. But the funniest one was one of the booksellers who said that they had an author who came in at a specific time each week and sat in the store and read his own book in the hope that other people would see him reading it, ask him what it was, and go and buy it. And then Irma says, like, and did anyone ever buy the book? And no, they did not. It's such a fantastic.
Yeah, great.
It's such a really fantastic episode. And also LinkedIn, I saw that the Kill Your Darlings have a little segment. Now I'm going to forget the name of it off the top of my head, but Michael Winkler was one of the people who was mentioned in it this week. Things I Wish I Knew, I think it's called. And this week's one is about self-publishing. And I saw it because Michael Winkler, who wrote Grimish, tweeted about it. And he talks about your relationship with indie booksellers. And I just think if there's one thing that authors and writers need to recognize, and which most already know, is that you have to have a good relationship with your local bookseller, and you've got to know that the booksellers are where it's at. They are the people in charge of ordering your book, selling your book, talking about your book to people, and just it's so worthwhile listening to what they say about what works. So that's a really good one that I would recommend. And then I really feel like I haven't dug deep enough in this article to talk about it at length. And I know that we are going to have an awkward conversation at some point this year about blurbing and endorsements, but I had to mention, because in the Sydney Review of Books this week, Katrina Menzies-Pike has done a book review of the book Fool's Gold. The article's called Fool's Gold. The book is by Louise Wilder and it's called Blurb Your Enthusiasm, An A to Z of Literary Persuasion. And the book that Katrina is reviewing is, I think she's a US writer who blurbs for a living, or who is in charge of blurbs. And in this case, we're talking blurbs as in those kind of endorsement quotes that we would do. And like we have talked about this before, we will talk about it again. Blurbing in the industry is a really big part of it. We get asked to blurb books or to write nice words about other people's books. We have to ask ourselves, other people, to blurb our books. Often if you write anything publicly about a book. So if I put something on Instagram about a book that I've liked and read, often that will get picked up by a publisher, or it will be retweeted, or sometimes a publisher will message and say, can we use that quote on the book? Absolutely fine. That's fine. But it is part of a big and, I would argue, growing industry. And this is kind of what she talks about. But I wanted to just read this little section that Katrina says, because I felt kind of sick reading the book. I felt like she was talking directly to me about my enthusiasm about books in general. She says this, I quote, I scroll through Twitter and see writers shouting out to their insanely talented, truly extraordinary friends, to their incredible new books, to their God-tier essays, to their game-changing stories, and I wonder how critical feedback can possibly be developed in such a hothouse. Mm. Gossip, bitchiness, and a certain maudlin pessimism may flourish behind the scenes and on private channels, but in public, the hype drowns out minor key mutterings. In these enthusiastic times, negative reviews cause shockwaves, and even those critics who adopt an ambivalent attitude to their subjects are treated as killjoys. So there's like a lot in here, right? Mm. I felt responsible. On one hand, I was like, oh my gosh, I am absolutely responsible and guilty of shouting from the rooftops enthusiasm for books, both those of people I know and people I don't know. Like, that is my general position. And partly that's because I don't post about books that I don't like. And that doesn't mean, I want to just really put in a little point here. If you know I've got your book and I haven't posted about it, that doesn't necessarily mean I don't like it. It just means I probably haven't got to reading it yet, or I've forgotten to post about it. So can I just put in that caveat there? But I do think, I know personally when I was asking, because I'm in that position now of asking people to do advanced readings of my book, like, it's this apology for taking up your time. Please, no obligation. This is why I'd like you to do it. I also understand the time. Like, it's just this ridiculous kind of machine. And maybe it does need to be kind of made more transparent and unpacked a little bit. Anyway, amazing article. We'll put a link in the show notes. Do you look at blurbs? Do you buy a book because of who blurbed it?
Not really, no. There is a blurb that I always remember because I was debating buying this book. I can't remember the book. It was a travel book, which I thought would be a bit like a Bill Bryson travel book. And one of the puff quotes was something like, this is a book for everyone who thinks travel writing has to be funny. And I was like, wow, great. That's going to be a funny book. But the blurb I meant it in the opposite way, as in, if you think it has to be funny, here's a really depressing version of a travel book that that you might regret paying for. The debate around genuine critiquing is a little bit like the debate around, are too many books sold? Of course, it's fascinating to hear a genuine criticism and to read genuine criticism, and we all learn from it. I just don't want it of my book.
Yes.
And it's exactly, you know, that thing of, but maybe too many books are being published, but I still want mine to be published.
Oh, and exactly the same. Maybe there's people have too many blurbs on their books and it's a ridiculous, you know, industry, and there should be a rule about how many times you allow it. Am I going to be the person who stands up and says, I'm making, you know, an integrity judgment on this and I'm asking for no endorsements? No, because it's not also at this point, it's not just about me. It's about the entire team of people who publish my book. So like exactly the same.
It's also just the sad thing about the internet, or the thing about the internet, in that in many years ago, if someone published a review of your book in the paper, you didn't have to engage. You could never know.
Yeah, whereas absolutely.
Someone will tag you now in a tweet and you'll wake up at 2 a.m. and have a Google alert on your name or something.
Not doing that this year. No Google alerts. Let's go to our feature segment with the amazing Jasper Peach. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Hardy Grant, and I'm delighted to be talking to Jasper Peach about their new book, You'll Be a Wonderful Parent, Advice and Encouragement for Rainbow Families of All Kinds. Jasper Peach lives on stolen Jarjar Wurrung country in Castlemaine, Victoria, with their wife and two children. They are a trans, non-binary and disabled writer, editor and broadcaster. Jasper served as guest co-editor for Archer Magazine's 16th edition, and their work appears in Higher Up, the Sydney Morning Herald, SBS Voices, and We've Got This, a book about parenting with a disability. Welcome, Jasper. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Can you please give us the pitch for this amazing book you've written with these just gorgeous illustrations by Quince Francis?
So You'll Be a Wonderful Parent is the bottled form of a conversation with someone you trust. It's a way to get the lowdown on what you might be experiencing if you're thinking about becoming a parent and you're part of the LGBTIQA plus community.
Fabulous. I know from listening to some interviews that you've done, and you've been doing a lot, we just talked about that, that the spark of this book came from a kind of an ongoing conversation that you were having with Ailsa Wild, who we've spoken to on the podcast. Can you tell us about the conversations that you had with Ailsa about the publication of her book, You'll Be a Wonderful Dad, and how that kind of begot your book?
Oh, Ailsa Wild, just a shining star of a human, just absolutely such a wonderful, wonderful person. I know Ailsa through an online parenting space, and we do this thing on Wednesdays where we talk about what's happening at work. And I'd been a civil marriage celebrant for about, I don't know, 15 or 18 years or something. And then the pandemic was happening and it was a bit dicey. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really like the work anymore, which is, you know, that, you know, it's time to bow out in that particular field. So I thought, oh, I quite like writing. I never really called what I was doing writing, but I've written always. And I've written 1,000 people's love stories and over the years. And I just said in this forum, I'm really interested in getting into writing. Does anyone have any advice? And Ailsa said, sure, send me your stuff and then let's have a Zoom. And she very generously gifted me her time, her wisdom. She took the time to read my stuff and really encouraged me and gave me some great advice going into things. And then a little while after that, Ailsa asked me if I could do a sensitivity read of her manuscript. And I said, sure, I'd love to, because I say yes to most things if they're from people I respect and if they're of interest to me. And I figure I can figure out how to do it. I can Google it or ask someone. So I was just like, yes, I'm very much up for doing a sensitivity read, having never done one before. And so I read this gorgeous manuscript for You'll Be a Wonderful Dad. And we had the meeting over Zoom again. And I basically said, like, I'm a pretty straight shooter. I was just like, look, this is a beautiful book. There's nothing here for me or my community. This is about a cisgendered heterosexual woman talking to a cisgendered heterosexual man who are both in cisgender relationships. So there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with what you've written, but it's not really going to land with my guys. So I guess what I know about Ailsa is that she is a person who loves all sorts of people. And I said, look, I think include in your book something about that, how it's really important when you're raising a child that they see you loving all sorts of people so they know that whoever they grow up to become, they'll be loved and valued and included. And then as a joke, I said, oh, you should tell your publisher to get someone to write a queer version of this. That'd be cool. As a throwaway line.
As the best ideas often are.
I know, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And so here we are. Yeah.
I love that. One of the things that you do in You'll Be a Wonderful Parent, Jasper, is include the stories and experiences of a huge range of different families, including yours. Mm. Can you tell us about what you describe as this alphabet soup of rainbow families that you wanted to include in the book and why this was so important?
I think I'll tackle the why it's so important first. Yep. Just with a little anecdote. So my workplace was previously people's weddings, and people get a bit loose at weddings, which is all great. But I'm at work, and the questions that people ask are really weird sometimes. Like someone came up to me and said, oh yeah, I know you've got 2 kids with your wife, and I've got this other queer friend, so, and then proceeded to ask me a lot of personal questions about it. So I think the reason why it's so important to include that broad collection of stories is because if you met one queer person, you've met one queer person. We none of us speak for all the others. We all have completely I guess, separate experiences in life. We're part of the same community, but it doesn't mean that my consent will be the same with someone else's consent, especially around information. So the other part of this is that I don't have the lived experience of being an intersex parent. I don't have the lived experience of being a kinship carer or a transmasculine birthing parent. So what I did was I didn't want to put an open call out because I guess for lots of reasons, but mainly because the internet is just full of a lot of dicey stuff and it felt more private than that. So I asked a couple of well-connected friends who are both coincidentally called Alex and are both queer. And I said, hey, you know everyone in the world. Can you tell me if you've got any people that fit the bill to kind of make sure that we've included as many stories as possible under this giant umbrella that covers gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex, asexual, queer, genderqueer, there's so many more words that, you know, it's difficult to cover all of them. But I wanted all of that in the mix because there's nothing worse than reaching for a book and thinking you're included and then go, oh, it's just for that part of the community. Okay. Which is a lot of people's experience in the LGBTIQI plus community reaching into parenting books and going, oh, that's for other parents. It's not for me. And that leads to all this, it sort of chips away. It's sort of like racism in Australia. It's very, you know, it's very insidious. It's not necessarily in your face, but it's through exclusion and it's through through not being included in so many things that we can feel less than.
One of the things that you talk about that members of this community, of the LGBTIQA plus community, as you so well put it, can often feel excluded from is some of the rituals surrounding birth and parenting and also the complexities of your own feelings when your wife was celebrating the impending birth of your child. Can you tell us a little bit about marking ritual and the importance of doing that in a way that feels right for your own family?
Yeah, it really shocked me the day that my partner went off with her oldest friend and they celebrated the impending arrival of our eldest child. And I was just sitting at home with my dogs just going, oh, I'm a mum too. I felt a bit silly, like but I'm not doing all the physical work of carrying this child. And then the flip side of that is I do ritual for a living. I know the importance and the transformative power of ritual and calling people in to bear witness to momentous times in your life. It was never about the legalities for me around weddings. It was more about seeing people celebrate possibility. And that can be applied to anything, freely. So I think I just want people to know that if there isn't a ritual that seems to work for you, and a lot of the well-worn path ones, they're not quite right. People just do them because that's what other people do. But if you actually stop and consider, well, why are we coming to someone's backyard and talking about is it a boy or a girl, and why are we watching someone open all the presents from a list that they've provided, and why, you know, and I'm not saying that in a critical way, I'm saying it in a curious way. Why do we do that? What are the benefits? Because we want to think ahead. What are the benefits of doing this, and what is it that we want to feel? I think we want to feel important, and that the fact that we're going through this sacred life passage is worth pausing and acknowledging and celebrating. So many ways to do that.
There's so many ways.
So many ways. Yeah.
Jasper, the book's beautiful. Like it's a beautiful thing to hold in your hands, to look at.
Isn't it so cute?
It's so cute. And the colour, everything about it, and the illustrations. The bold text in it, it's divided into six different sections. How did you and Quince, I'm not sure how this worked, decide what you wanted to include, how you wanted to structure it, and that kind of overall feel so that your reader is is drawn in through the path that they're drawn in and left at the beautiful spot they're left at too.
So how it worked was, and you'll know this, but I didn't know this. There are on the cover of the book, there might be one or two names, but my goodness, there are so many people who make this happen.
Yeah.
Everyone says this to me. Oh, it's so beautiful. It feels so nice. It's because it's friendly, right? It's not intimidating. It's accessible. It's not a dense text. You're not going to pick it up and flick through and go, oh, this is going to make me exhausted to read. I will never have time for this. It's, you know, you can flick through it in one sitting. You can go to any part of it and you can still get a sense of what's going on, even if you've got your attention on seven other things, which most parents do.
Yes.
All the time. All the livelong day. So how it worked was I submitted a manuscript of all the text and then my publisher, Emily Hart at Hardy Grant, gave me some suggestions. It was always an invitation to make a change. It was never, you must do this. It was such a respectful and gorgeous process of being so respected with what, I guess, what I valued and what I felt so strongly about including. And then we brought Amy Coops along to edit it because Amy's a fellow queer parent who also works in medical spaces. Amy's a doctor. So phenomenal fount of wisdom there and knowledge and experience, but also incredible literary skill. Because Amy is very good at surgical precision, Amy's very good at cutting through all of my waffle. Maybe notice there's a bit of waffle. And they would just sort of leave a comment in the Word document, go, so what do you mean by this? And usually I'd have to go, well, I just thought it was a pretty way to say I'm not sure what I'm saying. So what I actually think is this. And then we would sort of mold it into the right shape. So that was a huge process as well. And all of us were having huge personal lifetimes at the same time. So all of this vulnerability is kind of infused into the book. Quince had just had their first baby when they were working on the illustration. So that was an incredibly tender time for them. And oh gosh, just so much work has gone into this. But basically, once the text was good to go or nearly good to go, I got the publisher Emily asked me to write a wish list of all the illustrations that I'd like. So I just sort of went through the Word document. And went, oh, it'd be nice to have this. It'd be nice to have that. I did have a few really specific requests in there as well. That you know that some of them got through, which was really nice. And then the publisher went through what Quince came up with, and sometimes asked them to do adjustments about facial expressions or other things included. It was a very consultative process. Again, in terms of a diversity of body shapes, ethnicities, ages, all different ways of being human, I hope are really represented in this book.
Yeah, it's amazing. That revealing that Quince had just had their first child at the same time, and I know that you have young children.
Yeah.
How do you kind of manage the juggle? How did you get this work done around all the other things that you have in your life, Jasper?
Very badly. I run on adrenaline. It's sort of like managing your finances with high interest loans. It's not a good idea. Do not ask me for advice about how to manage the time. I ended up in hospital with double pneumonia because I was just like, oh, no, I'll just keep working on this and I'll go to the doctor later. And yeah, no, don't do that.
Don't do that.
Go straight away and get yourself checked out. So, look, yeah, I'm trying to learn from that experience and, put some different things in place. But over the last few months, this is kind of a bit left of center, but I've been doing a lot of trauma therapy and that's really helping me to understand what my natural pace is. I had no idea. I had no idea that my pace of being like a hummingbird and zigzag here, there, and everywhere. When I'm actually in my body and feeling what my natural pace is I'm a waddling wombat. You know, it can take me all day to cook a dinner, and that's okay. So more and more often I'm able to drop into my natural pace and not come from a fear-based or a deficit-based perception of time. Yeah.
That's a pretty amazing insight to have come to. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, making your first book is like a birth. It's, you gestate it, you grow it, you completely change, you turn yourself inside out, you dig and dig and dig and dig and dig to find the core and the marrow and the truth as best you can possibly represent it. And gee whiz, particularly when you're representing a marginalized community, there's a little bit of pressure. That's coming solely from me, really. No one outside of myself is putting any pressure on me. But, yeah, God, I don't want to get it wrong. You know, I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings or lead to anyone feeling excluded in any way.
Jasper, I want to ask, you make a note in the opening pages of the book about the fact that language is this rapidly evolving ecosystem, and you've got a wonderful metaphor in there about sand and gumboots too, which I loved. Why is language and the way it's used and the way it changes so important in particular to recognise in this book?
Sometimes there aren't words for who we are, and people in the LGBTIQA plus community, we're kind of fine with it. Well, I can't speak for everyone, but we recognise that that's a fact of life. But often other people will get a bit scratchy about that, you know, you're not a woman, but you're called mum. I'm not sure if that's okay. My children have no problem with it. They know who they are. They know who I am. Often there aren't words that are recognised by the wider community, but because we establish these families with such intention, there is a lot of deep thought that goes into it, and language is part of it.
I love the note in there too, which I think is useful in so many places, about almost an invitation that you're giving to your readers to say, and in future editions, maybe the language in here will be updated. If you know that really making it very clear that it's something that changes and something to be flexible with.
It's a living language. And I really do hope that we can update it. I hope that we can add more stories about more kinds of parents and more kinds of families. And ultimately, I hope that this would be a book we wouldn't need, but we do. I don't see it changing overnight. Maybe in the next, after I'm gone, I don't know, in 100 years, that this won't be necessary, because gender will be less relevant and sexuality will be less relevant and less of a sticking point. But already, what's it been out, a week and a half or something? I've been getting so many beautiful, vulnerable messages from readers from all over the world saying, I have sobbed my face off with my partner reading this book. We have never felt so seen and respected before. And the first message like that I got, I was like, good job done. That's all I wanted, was for one person to feel less alone.
Yeah. Jasper, there's lots of great advice in this book, including to nap as much as you can pre the arrival of the small human, and also conversely to let all advice slide off, as you describe yourself as Teflon. I'm wondering if you'd like to give us amusing or serious, both the worst birth or parenting advice that you were ever given and the best.
Look, the best advice, and this is in the book, my friend Laura gave me, I invited her around after our second baby was born, and I was flipping out big time. I was eventually diagnosed with postnatal anxiety, and that was a very hairy time. But I just couldn't figure out which way was up and who I was and how were we going to do it. And she said to me, you know, Jay, it's sort of like you throw cards up in the air when you have a baby. One day they'll land, and you look around and go, oh, there we are. You'll be right till then. And sometimes the you'll be right kind of advice can feel a bit like, well, no, it's not actually a problem what you're saying to me. But that felt really different. I felt like she really saw what it was that I was expressing, and gave a very reassuring from lived experience account of it will turn out okay. Mm. Oh, and one more top advice from my mate Kernsey, said to my partner and I, you're still yourselves, you've just got kids, you're the same people. and also the shops are still open. It's okay. You don't need to buy everything before the baby's born.
that is sort of the feeling though, isn't it? That one must.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah. Just I tried to buy all the onesies that I would need for the first 2 years in on sale. And just, you don't need to do that. It's okay.
Don't do that. On advice. Can you share, and it's lovely to hear that relationship with Ailsa about you kind of working into your writing. Can you share some writing advice with our first-time podcast listeners, something that maybe helped you along the path to writing this book?
Yeah, writing advice. I think, oh, gosh, let me have a think for a minute. Yeah, I think the best advice that I've received that I'll pass forward is to either join or create a writing community, whether it's online or you meet in a cafe once a month or whatever it is, get people around you at a similar, I guess, kind of phase that you're in so you can go through it together. There's this wonderful WhatsApp group of 2023 debut authors and it pings all day long. It's so, there's all these multiple flirtations going on. It's hilarious. It's so good. There's lots of people with greyhounds. It's a whole thing, right?
Oh my gosh, that sounds amazing.
It's so much fun. And so, you know, after this year's finished, I imagine we as a group would help the 2024 debut authors establish something like that, because it is so useful, so useful to be traveling along the roller coaster together, because there are so many ups and downs. In terms of if you're starting out a writing practice, keep writing. That's what Ailsa said to me. Yep. Keep writing. You're going great. You're doing well. You've got something there. Keep going. And if you're writing and you feel like you don't have something going there, do some courses. Figure out what it is that you feel less confident in and try and improve. Mm. Try it in a targeted way, not just I don't know how to do it and I'm just bad. No, that's not going to help anyone. You need to actually investigate how you can feel more confident and more empowered.
That's excellent advice. Oh, Jasper, can you recommend for us a debut book, any time or any genre?
Yes. So this one's not out yet, but it's a sneaky one that I got a sneaky copy of.
Excellent.
By Roz Bellamy. Have you heard about this? It's called Mood. So Roz Bellamy is this phenomenal person who is the editor-in-chief at Archer Magazine, a magazine about sexuality and gender. And they have written this incredible memoir about mental health and love and hope and intergenerational trauma and becoming who you are and finding your place in this world. And it is it's so delicious. It's like a really, you know, like a crumbly vanilla slice.
Yes,
it's that
I
kind
do.
Of feeling.
Oh.
Yeah. It's so creamy on the inside and then there's all this like flaky pastry and it's got all the different textures and it's so satisfying. So there are really, although, you know, the journey that Roz describes about mental health around bipolar and borderline personality disorder can be quite harrowing, they do it with such love and integrity and in a way that is so holding of the reader. So I can't wait for that wonderful book to come out sometime this year.
That sounds amazing. And I very much hope that Roz's publisher catches your description of this as a vanilla slice, because I think that perfectly needs to go, you know, as an endorsement on the front.
Yeah.
Jasper, I know that you are kind of super busy in this publication time. Where can people find where you are, get in touch with you? Are there some events that you've got coming up?
Yeah, so everything is on my Linktree. I haven't done a website. Do you need to do a website if you're an author?
You don't have to do a website. No. Linktree, I feel like Linktree works just as well.
Yeah, I just sort of clump all my I've got my book at the top, and then my events, and then interviews and stuff I've done under that. So, both of my kind of public social media things are Instagram and Twitter, and they're the same at Jasper Peach Says. So yeah, all my links are in my bio there. Excellent. Yeah,
we'll put that in the show notes for this. And Jasper, can I just say, you were just describing Roz's book in such loving terms, and I think you used the word like feels like they're holding the reader, and just that the feeling in reading You'll Be a Wonderful Parent is just exactly that. Like, you have such wisdom and insight and knowledge to share, but also this gentle, loving kind of hold of the reader. And I just hope that your book gets into as many hands of as many families as possible. Congratulations on it.
Thank you so much. That's what I wanted. I had this moment when I was 6 years old and I was at school, and I was surrounded by kids, and I felt lonely at the same time. And I realized that can happen. And I also felt this, I don't know if I heard a voice or felt a feeling or what witchy woo-woo stuff it was, but something in me said, you're going to write a book one day and someone will not feel lonely when they read your book. And that's all I hope for. Like, we're all individuals walking around in the world, but we've got each other. Mm-hmm. We're all we've got, really. So if you're an LGBTIQA plus person or an ally who would like to help out a mate from this community. The other thing I wanted to get across to people is the audiobook is going to be freely available to anyone. I just need to figure out where to put it, but I'll be recording that in the next week.
Oh, I was just about to say, is it you? Are you recording?
What a joy,
Jasper.
Yeah, it's lovely. My wonderful publisher, Hardy Grant, they took it to all of the audiobook platforms and they all rejected it because it was too short. And I know, but because the publisher knew how vital it is that this material be accessible, and I'm a disability activist, so they knew I wouldn't let it go ever. They said, look, you can have the rights and you can freely distribute it to anyone who needs it. So if anyone's got any ideas of where to put it, like if I should put it on a SoundCloud or YouTube, or what the best place would be, I'd love for you to get in touch with me via Twitter or Instagram, because I don't really know what I'm doing.
That's extraordinary, and I'm so glad that you are going to do that, and hopefully we can have a way to get that to people.
Thank
you so much for writing this book and for giving us your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for the chat.
What else have you been consuming, reading, listening to, watching?
Okay, so just an article that is a bit of an old one now. I've had it on the list of things I keep meaning to talk about. It's by James Earp. And it's called My Mentor John Hughes Taught Me How to Write, Then He Plagiarized My Work. Do you remember this? This probably came out in Jan. Yeah, fascinating article. So John Hughes is the person accused of plagiarism. His book, The Dogs, was longlisted for the Miles Franklin last year. It was published by Upswell. That is an interesting story in itself. When you look at the articles, The Guardian talk about it coming out as a plagiarized work or having plagiarism within it was the result of a Guardian investigation, which I just think is a really curious line to begin with.
Yeah.
This, you know, whether people are going out looking for plagiarism. I suspect someone raised a concern and then they document matched and found multiple similarities. But James Earp is a student, was a former student of Hughes, and talks very lovingly about Hughes and all the amazing things that Hughes did for him as a teacher and as a mentor. Reads as having had difficult teenage years, but also a difficult life in some ways. And so he has a lot of love for this former teacher and mentor. But he finds out that there are these sentences and bits and pieces that have been plagiarized, and they were things that Earp had written in a fairly obscure journal that he actually sent to Hughes because he was really particularly proud of it. But I think what's so interesting to me is this very human thing that anybody, I think, would do in the same situation is to feel very hurt and conflicted feelings, but then also to immediately take their work and put it side by side with the plagiarized work and parse why he has changed this word over that word. And I actually don't think that's better. And
I think they're the
parts.
Can't
help but be this complimented as well.
Yeah, they're the parts of that article. I think it's so exquisitely written, that article. And obviously, Earp is an extraordinarily talented writer, but those layers of complexity. And then also that kind of other layer of responding to the whole thing with words, you know, is another layer of it as well. But yeah, I remember reading it and thinking, wow, this is complex stuff. And this has been really dug down and dug through.
He's so generous about it too. I think the final line or a line towards the end is, I had decided privately that John was two things, a man that I knew and an author. He had, I felt, failed me as an author, but he had not failed me as a man, which is a very generous way of looking at things. Yeah, it's a great article.
Other things that I have been reading that I wanted to mention, the first book out from the new Joan imprint through Ellen and Unwin, which is Naki and Louie's imprint, named after her grandmother, I think, is the poetry collection, poetry memoir called Dress Rehearsals by Madison Godfrey. And I met Maddie at Margaret River a couple of years ago, and just an incredible poet and human who I was really delighted to meet. And this collection is the most extraordinary, fierce and gentle and clever and wise and insightful kind of coming of age memoir, is I think how it's described, about gender, about kind of coming to an understanding of their body and who they are, and just in the most beautiful language. And kind of that thing, like there's a lot of poems in there in mosh pits. There's a lot of anger in there. There's also a lot of just gorgeous, intimate moments, body moments. And I just think it is such a triumph. It's such a good selection as the first book with Joan. Mm. And I know that Madison is at Sydney Writers Festival, I think, appearing at Sydney Writers Festival. And I would just encourage everyone to get that book or get along to see Madison perform as well. So that's one I highly recommend. And then an early copy of Stephanie Bishop's new book, The Anniversary, arrived.
Started this.
Oh, my goodness. Spoilers. So could you put it down? Like, I know it's not on our list, right? Like, Stephanie's not on our list to interview right now. There's a lot of other books.
I was not going to like read it now, but then I picked it up and now I've bumped everything else that's sitting around it. Yeah.
That is exactly what happened to me. So just this, you know, I sat down, I thought I'll just read the first couple of pages. I really enjoyed Bishop's The Other Side of the World. I think maybe a second novel. Like, really enjoyed that. Haven't read the other ones, but I just started reading. Premise is a writer who has been awarded a prize and who's kind of en route to get that prize. Also, it's their wedding anniversary. They are married to an older man who's also in the industry. He's in the film industry. And she's booked them a spot on a cruise for their anniversary. And he goes overboard. Like, that's on the blurb. So that's no spoilers there. So it really is a literary thriller. Like, it's got a lot of kind of stuff about the internal workings of creative partnerships and of marriage and of the lit world and success and how works are formed. But also it's just also
a cruise ship.
It's very just cruise fun. Ship, just like this rollicking, pacey mystery on a cruise ship. Mm. So I'm super excited about seeing that land out in the world. And I really enjoyed it. So they're my two readings. And I've got a watching.
Interrupt before. My steady stream of Housewives and Vanderpump Rules.
So we were recommended. Etta, you might recall, my youngest, was a big fan of Stranger Things. That was our kind of like mum-daughter kind of thing that we watched together. older kid is out a lot doing other basketball things, we have like our special thing that we watch. Someone recommended the Mysterious Benedict Society. Did you recommend it?
It's really good. Yeah.
It's so good. We were
watching it. I think I've only watched the first three episodes, but the kids loved it. And that first episode as a setting up and creating something, geez, am I jealous of that. Like,
so jealous of that. It's such a good one. So I reckon like from seven-year-olds and up, like I'm loving it. But the best thing, and I think this is so good as just for kind of storytelling advice and what I so enjoy watching, is that in the finale of the first season, Etta and I just watched it together this week, and she kept stopping and pausing to go, oh my God, Mom, how good is that? Like on each of the reveals. And it was just way of remembering, this is what satisfying storytelling and all that setup and all the little hints that you've dropped along the way to get to that reveal and have a kid who's pausing to turn around just with like this glee in their eyes to say, what? How cool is like what we're aiming for, right?
It's even like that in the first episode, I reckon. So the premise is basically it's like a secret society that's recruiting special kids. Yeah. And so you watch this selection of special kids get recruited, and they each have a particular talent that makes them an important member of the society. But it's so clever, and you can see how watching it as a kid, you would want to be one of these orphans. Like,
yeah, you know, absolutely.
It is special based knack on for whatever.
It's obviously based on novels, so we will put a link into those. I don't know who the author is, unfortunately. I didn't do my research beforehand, but I'm very keen to go and read them too now to see if it was just a very, very fabulous adaptation, or if all of that extraordinary story is right there in the novels too, which I assume it is.
That's me. And that's it for today.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.